Hello everyone and welcome to episode 100, no less, of the oneliner.com's infinitely fantastic podcast. I, as always, am Craig Eastman. With us in Glasgow, Scott Morris.
Hey everybody.
And hopefully slightly more enthusiastically joining us from Falkirk, Drew Tavendale.
Oh,
it's not me, Drew.
Sorry, hello!
Am I the only one who feels alive tonight?
Is this on?
Can you back off the mic a bit?
Pretty packed show tonight for episode 100, so we're going to crack on. So then, guys, before we blast into the reviews and stuff, any sort of reminiscences or particular high points from the 100 podcasts we've recorded so far you'd like to talk about?
Nah.
Everything was equally dismal. No, I very much enjoyed doing the Edinburgh podcast shows. We didn't do it this year because, well, real life kind of gets in the way occasionally, but they're always fun.
Didn't enjoy it that much then, eh? No, I have to say I'm quite envious of the Edinburgh Festival stuff that you guys have done, because obviously geographically it was not impossible, but certainly difficult for me to find the time to sort of come up there and join you for them. So I very much enjoyed listening in to the Edinburgh.
Yeah, the festival stuff was good. It was fun to do, and it was quite nice to see stuff that you're really not going to see anywhere else outside of a film festival.
Often for very good reason, but...
often you get a little gem as well.
Let's not speak in past tense, say the Edinburgh Festival was enjoyable, because presumably we're going to hit it up again, yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly nice to be able to perhaps bring a little gem to our listeners' attention that they might otherwise never even heard of, let alone had a chance to see, and good chance that some of them they'll have been able to seek out.
But you see, Craig, I've not been thinking too much about the previous 100. I'm already thinking to the next 100.
Wow, great answer. I'm struggling to remember the last 100, to be honest with you. Where has time gone? I occasionally sort of flick back through the podcast listing on our RSS stream and iTunes and look at some of the films we've discussed and whatnot and think, oh, Jesus Christ, I have no recollection of that whatsoever. I'm even sometimes surprised. I'm at that point now where when I was younger, I used to get frustrated at my parents. I'm like, no, you've seen this film. You have seen it. It's the one where that guy does that thing. And now I look back even just like 25 episodes ago and like look at the sort of reviews I contributed to and think, did I see that?
Was I just guessing?
Maybe not 25 episodes ago, but when you get past like 60 or so, it starts to get a little bit blurry. But I shudder to think, I mean, obviously, since we started recording this podcast, I definitely haven't seen half as many films on general release as you guys have. Obviously, before I moved down here, we were all three of us seeing sort of everything pretty much that was on general release. So can I just say that for the last 100 episodes, or 99 episodes if you want to be accurate, not including this one, obviously, it's been a pleasure listening to you guys talk about films that I haven't been bothered to get off the sofa and go and see. I found your opinions very informative. And for the time you've invested, I thank you.
Well, in many ways, you're our target audience, and I'm sure for a while you were our only audience. That's good.
This podcast solely for my benefit. No, I think it's fair to say that I've got probably the easiest job out of the three of us in terms of this. And at the very least, you guys sort of make some commitment to see a lot of these films, whereas I just don't do that anymore. But it's great fun just recording this stuff anyway, just knowing that hopefully there are people listening out there and who appreciate the time you've put in. And yeah, I sincerely hope we have another 100 episodes to talk about. And how many years have we been doing this now?
We started with our first episode on 30th of September 2007.
Oh, Jesus.
So just over 5 years
and
now.
If anyone would like a laugh, go back and listen to that first episode, if you can, and make it out through the
Before we'd boss any of it.
Broadcasting from inside a dustbin, I think, by the sound of it.
No, it's my flat. I can see where it's a... I can see the comparison, but still...
Yeah, no, before any of us had bothered to invest in halfway decent microphones.
I don't know, 20 episodes per year on average doesn't seem too bad either.
No, that's reasonably good going. That's an average of just less than two a month, which we've done well to keep that schedule up when I think about it. I think now of like Titanic gaps where we like went almost 2 months without doing one and stuff.
Yeah, that's what surprised me. Yeah. It's been quite... such a high ratio per year.
Yeah, for argument's sake, 100 episodes in 60 months. So there you go. So yeah, 1.4 episodes a month or thereabouts.
I was thinking this is perhaps not the best form to raise it, but perhaps we should start including some more things like foreign films, which otherwise we don't quite get the opportunity to see. I was thinking back just to some of the ones I liked, and it was one that I did particularly enjoy was the Zero Sum Hammer Games, which was largely inspired by Korean films and their violent tendencies. But it was the first time in a while I'd actually had a chance to sit down and watch a bunch of foreign films which I hadn't seen for a good long while. So maybe we'll do some more of that going forward.
I think, yeah, I'd like to see us expand our scope a little bit and maybe do some separate stuff. Maybe even, dare I mention it, maintain sort of a couple of different streams.
Yes, perhaps not a bad idea. One thing we've been kicking around is, well, as part of this 100th anniversary spectacular, I did some redesign work on the website, so it has a somewhat updated look and feel, but it's also got a blog section as well if you want to just chime in with random opinions on arbitrary stuff. So perhaps we could have a blog cast where we just talk about randomness rather than particularly based around current film schedules.
Yes, why not indeed? Something like that. And also imperative is you guys, please, if you're listening to this right now, pause this podcast right now and go to iTunes and just take 10 seconds to rate the podcast, because it will help immensely in the rankings. Any feedback via iTunes is the best possible feedback and the best possible exposure we can have.
That's the main way people are going to find out about us.
You could also tattoo the one-liner on your forehead. That helps as well.
It does.
I understand if you just leave a review in iTunes instead. It's probably easier to do in the short term.
Or just use magic marker. It's not that difficult to buy a bus and sort of stencil the side of the bus with an advertorial for us. Or no, maybe. Yeah, stick to iTunes. Stick to iTunes. Yeah. No, but I mean, you know, we don't ask any money for this. We do this entirely out of our free time. We fork out hundreds of pounds here and there for sort of like microphones and all that sort of equipment just for the love of doing it. So all we ask in return is, other than your continued listenership, is if you get 10 seconds, just, you know, do us that courtesy and rate us on iTunes, leave a review. We will love you until the end of time. Yes, so that begging aside, let's branch out and do some shit. That's what we should aim to do for the next 100 episodes. We should diversify a bit.
Yes.
So, gentlemen, a busy podcast for us. We'll be speaking about The Oranges, Silver Linings Playbook, Great Expectations, End of Watch, Seven Psychopaths, and Trouble with the Curve, which is a nice little melange of titles there to consider. So I guess without further ado, we will kick off with Scott and a summation of The Oranges, if you don't mind, sir.
We are rapidly approaching, as you cannot possibly have escaped your attention, Christmas, and there's something of a filmic Christmas tradition that is not based purely around animated films for kids or things about Santa Claus, but there also seems to be every year there's at least one sort of pretty dismal family drama centred around the fact that your families are kind of coming back together at like Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year, that kind of period. And this year's effort is The Oranges. The trailer for it did seem to make it skew rather more towards the kind of comedy end, the drama, and I suppose I had some small expectations for it. I mean, it has a pretty damn solid cast. You've got Catherine Keener, Oliver Platt, Hugh Laurie, and Arrested Development's Alia Shawkat, and that's not a bad cast. I mean, how bad could that be? You may already have inferred my opinion of this from the questioning tone of the above, but...
questioning, bordering on accusatory.
The setup's fairly simple. There's two families, the Ostroffs and the Wallings. They live opposite each other in a sleepy New Jersey suburb, and the families have generally been the best of friends for many years. The kids have grown up together, and although Nina Ostroff, played by Leighton Meester, and Vanessa Walling, played by Alia Shawkat, they've long since stopped getting on as they went through the school system, but still, Nina hasn't actually been home for years while Vanessa sits in her room putting together a graphic design portfolio, so it's not really been much of a cause for concern lately. The rest of the families get on like a flaming semi-detached. The fire brigade shows up when Nina returns after splitting up with her fiancé. Hugh Laurie's David Walling, his marriage to Paige, played by Catherine Keener, has been on a fairly shaky peg for a while, and this gets rapidly shakier when it's discovered that David has embarked on an affair with Nina, who is, of course, pretty much half David's age. The fallout from this affects, as you can imagine, the dynamics of all of the relationships aforementioned, and perhaps there's not much point in expanding on any of them. I'm fairly sure you can more or less imagine them yourself, which is sort of the problem. There's not really anything new in The Oranges, or anything much of interest. It's not an unwatchable film, but there's really nothing earth-shattering at all in the script, and it's quite far from granting anyone any insights into human nature. Apparently, having an affair could have negative consequences. Who knew?
What?
Eye-opening.
So there's not really any hook to any of the characters. It kind of gets off a little bit because the actors portraying them are a fairly charismatic bunch, and they kind of impart some life to them that is probably more than the film deserves. Any lesser cast would have rendered this dreadful rather than simply ill-advised, but even then, there's no real reason to choose this over any number of much better family dramas. I guess it's on here as counter-programming for stuff like The Hobbit that's soon to be murdering everyone in the cinemas fairly shortly, but it's really just not very good. It's not a particularly interesting adult drama. There's not much drama, and it's not particularly adult, so I'd say give this one a body's worth.
Oh, damn.
Sounds
like
dreary.
A knife to the heart. I'll be honest with you and say I'd actually heard nothing about The Oranges until after we started recording this podcast, and I bothered to bring up the list of titles we'd be talking about tonight. So
yeah, I managed to pass me by completely until Scott said, I saw The Oranges, it's not good. Okay, so good, I hadn't even known of its existence.
No, exactly. Swiftly on then to the Silver Linings Playbook, in which Bradley Cooper, woman's favourite, and I'm not bitter that he's my wife's favourite, is some dude. Scott, what's Silver Linings Playbook? Do you have a summation for this? Because I've prepared nothing. I can offer you my opinion, something. But not a salient sort of introduction.
This is what people have stuck with us for 100 episodes for, isn't it?
Well, I can go on my spiel if you want me to.
Please do.
Right. The logic behind going to see this film is simple, because, well, it's a film, and watching films is sort of what we do. Now, I hadn't really found out anything about this film at all other than the trailer. And the trailer looked like it was sort of bouncing about between being either mawkish or mocking, and noting that it contains Bradley Cooper, which is rarely a positive, and Robert De Niro, which obviously is an invitation to run screaming the other way rather than sit down and watch it. I wasn't filled with a lot of positive vibes towards it, but I expected little, and it delivered more than it promised. Although we'll come back to this issue of expectations later, I'd imagine. So, the general gist of it, you have Bradley Cooper's Pat, who is struggling to get over a mental breakdown, and his coping strategy appears to be based around maintaining a positive mental attitude with the ultimate, albeit unrealistic, goal of getting his wife back. Fate, assisted by his old friends, throws Pat together with a near equally damaged Tiffany, played by Jennifer Lawrence, who until recently had been trying to cope with the sudden loss of her husband with a series of shallow sexual encounters. Pat's moved back in with his parents, Dolores, and Pat Sr., Bobby De Niro. Pat Sr. is hardly a suitable role model, having quit his job in favour of becoming the local bookmaker and displaying more than a few strange compulsive habits himself. Now, there's something of a narrative driving force imposed on the film by an unusual bet based on Pat and Tiffany's performance in a dancing contest that probably does not warrant any scrutiny. It's a transparent, or at very least quite highly translucent, method of keeping Pat and Tiffany bound together to further develop their relationship and characters. And to be fair, it does that quite successfully. The main thread of the film turns out to be the developing relationship between Pat and Tiffany, with a particular focus on teasing out the details of the incident that caused Pat's departure from reality and getting some more of the details out from that. That aspect perhaps works better than Pat and Tiffany's relationship, probably because Bradley Cooper, well, he's not going to be high on anyone's go-to list for powerhouse character acting turns, but as it happens, he puts together a pretty reasonable and convincing-ish turn portraying Pat's mental anguish and his overcompensating positivity. Lawrence also does reasonably well, although I can't help but feel her character has been drawn with rather fewer pencils and doesn't get to anywhere near as rounded a status as Cooper's, which is somewhat unfortunate. And it's perhaps that aspect more than anything else that stops their relationship and their characters moving from the levels of good enough for this sort of thing to good enough to actually move you. The characters, performances, and the narrative that David O. Russell has scared up from this novel adaptation are sufficient to tell an engaging story and one that's worth watching, but I don't think it's up to the standard of any of Russell's previous works, or at least most of them, and it's certainly not an Oscar contender. To his credit, he's avoided mawkish over-sentimentality. The tone's pitched just the right side of occasionally light-hearted, rather than outright mocking, of the character's mental problems, and that's a pretty tricky tightrope to walk. So he does deserve some respect for that. And overall, Silver Linings Playbook is an above-average film, but it's not a spectacular film, which was why I was quite surprised to find out that it had garnered quite so high a reputation on coming out and doing a bit of searching around. There's so much Oscar buzz about this, and I can't really work out why, unless it's the usual predilection for Oscar-liking people that are mentally ill, and this has got three of them, so I suppose that's it's a shoo-in for that.
It's got more than three, goodness. I'm interested to hear you say that, actually, because it sounds as though perhaps on this occasion your opinion might be broadly in line with my own. I've heard people discuss this film elsewhere and say that it's the kind of film that will, what you take from it will depend upon what you bring to it, and I can't help but feel that I've missed something here as well, because before I went to see the film, like yourself, Scott, I was sort of expecting well, I don't know 100% what I was expecting, but something a bit more of a powerhouse. I mean, given David O. Russell's track record, even on the occasion where he's not been sort of attempting to deliver, you know, heavyweight drama, I'm thinking along the lines of I Heart Huckabees and stuff like that, then at the very least he's proven sort of quite eccentric in his choice of material. And here, yeah, this was much more sort of a down the line romantic drama than I expected it to be. I think perhaps when I went in, I expected more of a sort of insightful look at depression and, or well, more specifically bipolar disorder, which is, I believe, Pat's condition, though it's not really ever discussed that much. It manifests itself in a lot of ways, but there's never any sort of great discussion into it. I think perhaps I was expecting more of an insight into that and more of a discussion of it. And in the end, actually, it's a far more conventional sort of romantic comedy drama, which just happens to have these characters who sort of orbit around severe emotional distress and sort of depression than you might in normal circumstances.
Yeah, it feels kind of more like window dressing than anything else.
Yeah, but then perhaps I think to myself, perhaps that's more fool me for expecting Hollywood to sort of give any money to, or even greenlight a project that would deal wholly with depression and sort of the reality therewith. I have the distinct feeling that if I were to go back and watch this film in a different frame of mind and actually take it on face value as what it is, somewhat paradoxically, now that I know what it is, that maybe I'll enjoy it more on a second viewing. But I couldn't help but feel a bit let down given the, like you say, I mean, the kind of awards buzz that it's already generated. And, I mean, fair play to Bradley Cooper. He's been threatening to do something serious for a while, but I can't help but feel he's one of those actors who's probably been a bit hamstrung by his rugged good looks and irresistibility to women, and that he's been given these sort of leading man action roles and things and nothing really too serious. And I imagine this is probably something that has taken a bit of faith on someone's part to give him this role, and he's actually tackled it really well and proven that he does have some kind of acting chops. Yeah. I thought he was perfectly reasonable in the role. I mean, like you say, not stellar, but Jennifer Lawrence probably arguably more of a proven acting talent with things like Winter's Bone in her resume. But sort of tangentially, she in this film has perhaps been given less to do than she might otherwise have done. But again, she fills the role well, and she is Jennifer Lawrence, so she gets a pass. But yeah, it's strange that it's gathered quite so much momentum. It's one of those films that I came out of thinking, not so much I don't know what to make of that film, but just given what I make of that film, I'm surprised that it's received it's had quite the reception that it has.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely walked out of it liking it. Because I went into that not really knowing anything much about it, when I came out, I was actually quite positive. I thought it delivered more than I thought it would have done, just based on the trailer. But as soon as I just did a little bit of digging around and people were throwing around, you know, Oscar contenders and things like that, I was somewhat puzzled by it, because it is quite good, but that's all it is. And I mean, it wouldn't even trouble my top 10 list in a year that I've really not seen as many films as I ought to. So calling it the best film of the year, I think, is perhaps over egging the pudding somewhat, but it's not a bad film, and it's definitely worth a look.
No, it's weird. It's almost, you would almost rather have played it just as a straight romantic comedy, actually, because in the end, it feels as though perhaps they've been quite wary about approaching the deeper emotional issues and the distress of Pat and Tiffany's depression. It's as though they've sort of warded away from dealing with that too directly, which throughout the film there are points throughout the film at which sort of Pat's irrationality manifests itself, and it feels slightly more out of place for the fact that actually they haven't sort of gone all in and invested as much as I'd expected in terms of the issue of depression. So when those episodes of irrationality sort of do come about, and this sort of bizarre behaviour when they manifest themselves, it feels slightly more disjointed than probably it would if they'd been more sincere about tackling the subject as I had expected. But again, I mean, is that just my faulty expectation? And then I think, well, it's kind of how it was marketed to me. So
it does have something of a downside, where it shows some of these outbreaks and things like that, and then more or less it just sweeps under the carpet and doesn't really have that effect anything that happens later on. You know, it's, yeah. By the next scene, everything's forgotten, and he's just back to being a quirky guy running in a bin bag.
If anything, there's too few of these interludes. And the other point I had as well was that the sort of the snappy dialogue of the trailer. It's one of those films where if you watch the trailer, you think to yourself, well, this is quite sort of, it's quite sharply written, and there's a lot of sort of witty banter between the characters and stuff. But you'll actually find that almost all of those good moments of that are in the trailer, and there's the actual film as a whole is not quite so. It doesn't get by on that sort of witty banter and snappy dialogue alone either. So, but I would agree, yeah, it's probably it's not that I didn't enjoy the film. It's just perhaps that either I had false expectations or my expectations were realistic and they weren't entirely met. But I suspect it's one of those. I look forward to catching up with it on demand and reassessing it from the comfort of my sofa without having to pay quite the exorbitant fee. But yeah, a good film, but not spectacular, like you say. I wouldn't have expected it to trouble anyone's sort of end of year list, except the fact it's there.
Yeah.
So, and the end of year list of more than one person whose opinion I respect and such things. So, yeah, strange one. Not entirely unfulfilling. Don't let it put you off going to see it if you were looking forward to it. But yeah, just can't help but feel it's been slightly falsely overrated. So, on to Great Expectations, which I believe was originally written by some guy called Dickens or something like that, Scott. I'm not sure. I don't think it's a very well known text.
Yeah, it's quite obscure. The title's partly accurate, I suppose, if you insert a negation in there somewhere. I've only ever agreed to call this work of Dickens a classic because it's old, rather than because it's any good at all. So I wasn't exactly chomping at the bit to get into Mike Newell's adaptation. However, as we've discussed previously, it's definitely a film, so I suppose I should go and see it. There was no shortage of talent behind it, though, so I suppose I had some small expectations for it. I'm going to assume that I can provide spoilers for this because it's over a century and a half old. I don't know what the statute of limitations is.
But, too soon.
If you don't want to know the results, look away now. That said, I will give you the most potted recap of The Great Expectations that's liable to exist anywhere. A mental old woman raises a daughter to have no capacity for love, to somehow take revenge on men in general for her being jilted at the altar. An orphan boy gets hired as a playmate for this mini ice queen, who promptly falls in love with her. Years later, the orphan boy mysteriously comes into a bunch of cash and moves to London, which then, as now, is full of total dicks, and he starts becoming a dick himself. He runs into this ice queen again, which kicks off another bout of anguish and uncovering concentric circles of increasingly stupid coincidences, secrets and plots. It peters out into a sort of happy ending that no one involved deserves. I'm not a fan, as perhaps you can tell.
Aww.
I've never liked this Dickens book. I'm not a huge Dickens fan in general, but Great Expectations is perhaps the one that I can get behind the least.
Can I just ask you at this point, Scott, before you go too far, is this the one with a dude called Pumblechook?
That's the bunny.
Yes, I remember bullshitting my high school fourth year English teacher about having read it when clearly I hadn't.
And in this one, Pumblechook's played by David Walliams, so that's a twofer.
Oh, how I wish I'd read that book now and had some insight into the no doubt complex and multi-layered character that David Walliams is bound to have portrayed.
Yeah, it's as bad as you're imagining.
Have you read some sort of subtext in my... It's like you're psychic, man.
I know you too well.
Sometimes you scare me.
Never been a fan of this, and I'm sorry if that makes me a barbarian, but this has examples of most of the things I really dislike about Dickens' works. It's got the most ludicrous caricatures of uniformly dreadful adults, and some of the children, to be fair. The plots are just a nonsensical collusion of strands that occasionally accidentally form a daft story, and there's no real message to take from it other than that people can be dicks. Thanks, Charlie. This has done very little to change my opinion of the source material, but if I can turn off my disapproval fountain for a while, I suppose I can report that mechanically this is as good a telling of the story as you could possibly hope for. Mike Newell brings together some lavish production values, and he's clearly learned how to manage large budgets quite well from his experience back in the days at Hogwarts. Ye olde London looks like a suitably cesspool-like, and the half-ruined, dusty old manor house looks pretty tremendous as well. The costume design for Helena Bonham Carter's Miss Havisham's pretty fantastic. The actors, of course, more than hold up their end of the bargain. Got solid, established hands like Ralphie Fiennes, Bonham Carter, of course, and Robbie Coltrane, and they're doing really solid turns for the youngsters to bounce off. Said John Leeds, Holiday Granger, and Jeremy Irvin provide pretty reasonably convincing portrayals of Fire and Ice, and it's not exactly their fault I can't bring myself to invest in their characters. It's just a story I don't really care for very much, and I have to give this version some credit, as I wasn't bored by it, which I was thoroughly expecting going into, because I just have no real respect for the source material. I just feel it's a really well-made film that could so much use a better story than the one that it's been lumbered with. Suppose you get what you get and don't be upset. It's one of these frustrating ones that everything in it is really well done. I can't, mechanically, there's nothing much wrong with this at all. Fantastic performances, looks really brilliant, story absolute drivel. If you are of the opinion that this work is actually quite good, then I'm sure you will love Great Expectations. It is a good film with the most dreadful story attached to it. So that's my general opinion of it. As I say, if you're somewhat more friendly towards the source material, then I would recommend this quite highly. But don't let me convince you of that, because I think it's a dreadful, dreadful story full of stupid plot details and stupid characters. But what do I know? It survived for 150 years, so we'll see if these podcasts are still going in 150 years and we'll do a comparison. So,
doubtless.
Yeah.
I'd like to see Dickens.
I'd like to see
this.
Him podcast.
Yeah.
Where's his podcast?
Yeah, and also Scott, when syphilis has been going for more than 150 years, so it's no guarantee of
that
quality.
That is true. We'll compare syphilis, this podcast, and Charles Dickens in 150 years, and we'll see who wins.
Yeah.
I think our odds are quite good.
Yeah, exactly. Syphilis, Dickens, slammed. So, Drew, tell us something about our man Clint Eastwood's latest starring effort, Trouble with the Curve.
After he announced the end of his acting career with 28's Gran Torino, it's quite surprising to find Clint Eastwood once again in front of the camera, and even more so, I would say, for it to be the first time since 1993 that he himself wasn't also behind the camera. His return from acting retirement is in Trouble with the Curve, as you say, which is the story of an ageing baseball scout with failing eyesight, and is directed not by Eastwood, but by Eastwood's numerous times assistant director Robert Lawrence, making his debut as a full director. So, valiantly exploring new ground here, Clint Eastwood plays Gus, a crotchety old man with fractious relationships with those close to him, most notably his lawyer daughter Mickey, played by Amy Adams. Now, hanging over Gus is the threat of being replaced by Sabermetrics, perhaps more commonly known as Moneyball devotee Phil, who thinks that computers can tell you more about a player than a seasoned coach. So they set out on a scouting trip determined to prove that it takes more than a laptop and a bunch of statistics to spot talent. At the suggestion of Gussie's best friend, played by John Goodman, he's joined on the trip by his daughter Mickey, and the two explore the relationship, or perhaps more appropriately, the lack thereof. Trouble with the Curve is fairly leisurely paced, but it doesn't bore, and Lorenzi's direction is confident and solid, if unspectacular. There are notable upsides, so Amy Adams acquits herself particularly well as a sparky foil to Eastwood in some of the more vibrant scenes. Absolutely superb bit of casting in the character who wants Gussie's job, wants to replace him with and his ilk with spreadsheets, is Phil, who's a sleazy, smug idiot hole. So they've cast Matthew Lillard to play him, which is about as good as you can get for trying to get sleazy unlikable. Justin Timberlake's also in it, as Gussie's former scouting find turned scout himself. I mean, and he's likable enough, but the romantic subplot between him and Amy Adams is flaccid and forgettable. Now, the plot's engaging enough, but there's not a great deal more to say, because everything happens exactly as you'd expect it to. Nothing that happens will surprise you in any way. But Trouble with the Curve is definitely worth a watch, if for nothing more than the enjoyment of watching old Clint. He may have been playing more or less the same character for the last two decades now, but it hasn't yet stopped being entertaining.
Yeah! Scott, is there anything you care to add to that?
I will largely just echo everything Drew said. I enjoyed it quite a lot. I quite liked it. It is in no way at all original in any regard, but I think it's executed very well.
Absolutely not.
It does. It takes a fairly mediocre script and does it as well as you could possibly hope for, I think. And it kind of elevates its game somewhat. And I think the folks behind the casting really deserve most of the plaudits for this. I've not seen a film better cast in probably this year. No one as the speech at the Republican conference shows, does a deluded old man better than Clint Eastwood.
So, yeah, but you can't not love him.
Exactly, and it's great fun watching him. As Drew says, as villains go, there's no one quite as punchable as Matthew Lillard.
It's a face you'd never tire of firing Christmas myself at.
By this point, you have to recognise that Justin Timberlake's either the world's best actor or actually quite a decent guy. The relationship with Amy Adams isn't particularly setting the heather on fire, but I didn't think it was bad. I didn't think it detracted from the film too much. So overall, yeah, I'd rather enjoy it. I would. At worst, it's inoffensive. And at best, it's somewhat better than that. So, yeah, definitely worth a look.
I've got to say, I haven't seen Trouble with the Curve, but I will catch up with it because it's Clint Eastwood. And despite how Clint Eastwood may be weathering the storm of age in terms of, as you say...
talking to a chair for half an hour.
Appearances at political rallies. I would pay money to watch Clint Eastwood talk an empty chair. I'd pay good money just to watch Clint Eastwood grumble at a boiled egg for 90 minutes, to be honest. So I'm quite sure I would enjoy Trouble with the Curve, and therefore I would recommend anyone check it out. That's my opinion. So Scott, Martin McDonagh in Bruges fame has finally got round to his next movie, and that would be the fantastically named Seven Psychopaths. What can you tell us about that?
It's a film about seven psychopaths.
What?
How many of them are there, Scott?
There are seven.
And they're what now?
They're psychopaths.
Right, just wanted to get that clear, yes. Thank you.
Well, actually there actually aren't seven psychopaths. It's the name of a script that Marty, who is Colin Farrell's character...
Act. Sale of goods act. I want my money back.
Now, depending on how you count it, you might wind up getting your way to Seven Psychopaths, but when you start watching the film, you're joining Colin Farrell as Marty, who's a writer struggling to get his next work out the door, partly due to the alcoholic haze he's walking through. This script is the titular Seven Psychopaths, although at the time of writing, he's currently only got one of them, and by his own admission, he's really more of a Buddhist than a psychopath. Easy mistake to make. His friend, struggling actor and dog kidnapper Billy, played by Sam Rockwell, tries to help him along by pointing out that there's a real-life psycho running around, the Jack of Diamonds, who's running around killing mid-to-high-ranking members of the LA organised crime scene. The dog kidnapping part is run with Hans, played by Christopher Walken, although they look to come a cropper when they accidentally target the Shih Tzu belonging to mob boss Charlie, played by Woody Harrelson. This starts a spiral of recriminations that's the closest thing that Seven Psychopaths comes to a plot. Now, if you're going to pick flaws with Seven Psychopaths, there's one very obvious one. It's a narrative disaster zone of such severity that the scriptwriting arm of FEMA has been called in to stop the worst of the damage. It's based as much on showing imagined vignettes of pieces of the script that Marty's writing as it is the real story, which is perhaps more far-fetched than any of the purposefully extreme examples from Marty and Co's imaginations. So, parts of the intended script's narrative wind up being woven, whether by chance or design, into the gang's reality, so it very much has that Charlie Kaufman thing going for it. This is sort of interesting in a way, but perhaps a decade or so too late. After all, the Charlie Kaufman thing isn't really working for Charlie Kaufman anymore, as Schenectady, New York would prove. So the diet Charlie Kaufman on show here isn't perhaps the film's strongest selling point. And if it is trying to make any points about storytelling, it's a swing and a miss. Though you could argue that it doesn't even swing. There's seems to be some kind of attempt to grasp at something, but what it's reaching for is never particularly clear. So, total disaster then? No, because it's really bloody funny. That, of course, will be something that's down to your individual tastes, and it's kind of tough to pass judgment on that basis. Unfortunate for people who are reviewing the film, I suppose. But the trailers have done a pretty reasonable job of portraying the general tone of the film without giving away any of the best bits, which is a complete rarity these days.
That's nigh on unheard of, Scott.
So at the risk of copping out completely, if the trailer seems appealing to you, then you'll like the film. Also, if you liked In Bruges, of course, then you will like this film. It shares very little in common with the other than the kind of general tone of it, but it is equally sharply written, and yeah, it is particularly funny. Now, it's not a bad taste comedy by any stretch, although some aspects of it are certainly in bad taste, given that it's in part a pastiche of bloodthirsty killer movies. It's played for laughs rather than any intent to scare or disturb people, but there's still an ungodly amount of blood on display at points. It has a fantastic turn from Christopher Walken, although the bulk of the plaudits have to go to Sam Rockwell's exuberant and unhinged performance, grounded by Farrell's surprisingly adept straight man role. It drives forward relentlessly and energetically with some memorable characters and gags. It's perhaps not quite up to the high watermark that In Bruges established, but it's floating pretty high up alongside it. One of the funniest films I have seen this year, so therefore, you should go and see it. That is my review of it. I hope you enjoyed it.
Yes, yes, we did.
I really did enjoy this film very much. A lot of really good gags in it. So actually, for some reason, they picked some of the weakest ones for the trailer, which I thought was unique and perhaps contrary to the point of actually doing a trailer. But no, it saved an awful lot of good stuff there that you wouldn't see from anything you've seen before, so it's definitely well worth a look.
Sweet as that, mate. Sweet as that. I'd make a point of catching up with Seven Psychopaths purely in respect of how much I enjoyed In Bruges. I understand it's probably not as, how shall we say, let's not say. Okay then, so excuse me while I scratch my head. All right then, so we spoke about Silver Linings Playbook earlier, which has had any number of sort of awards buzz around it. Another film which is gathering strong word of mouth would be End of Watch. Scott, what be that aboot?
Write about what you know is the oft-repeated advice. I suppose in that case, David Ayer knows quite a lot about LA Cops, given that it seems to be the only thing he ever writes about. With somewhat variable results, Training Day came forth from his pen and was, in my opinion, somewhat fortunate to get one of them little gold statues there. But it's a pretty solid film.
But also at the same point, though, Fast and the
That's
Furious.
That is true. Even cop-related, other outings like Dark Blue and SWAT weren't particularly good.
Harsh Times I've not seen, but it was considered quite well. Street Kings was actually reasonably interesting. But SWAT and Dark Blue were awful.
To be honest, the only notable thing about Harsh Times that I can remember from when I saw it was that it has the only dismal performance from Christian Bale that I've seen in about 20 years. So, yeah, mixed bag. So I didn't really have a lot of expectations for his latest, unsurprisingly, an LA cop movie. This one follows young patrol officers Brian Taylor, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, and Mike Zavala, played by Michael Pena, on their routes around the less than glamorous South Central areas. With heavy gang presences in the area and a constant tension between the encroaching Mexican-dominated gangs and the established gangs vying for control of territory and drug distribution, it's not a particularly nice place to be. The framing device for all this is Taylor's night school film course, a project that sees him filming his experiences with either a camcorder or clip-on cameras for that maximum shaky camness look. Narrative-wise, it feels almost as though this was a format for a mini-series rather than and something that's just been taken and squashed into a film format, with Taylor and Zavala taking, through blind happenstance more than anything else, a number of calls to small-ish incidents that are all tied back to the Mexican cartels. Now, you don't really want to be on a Mexican drug cartel's radar, as the events of the last reel or so of the film prove. That said, any main through line is probably less any criminal investigation, as it is the relationship between Taylor and Zavala, and the developing romance with Janet, played by Anna Kendrick, that becomes a marriage over the span of the film. It's fortunate then that the Gyllenhaal-Pena act works so well. Their friendship and respect for each other is engaging and believable, and their banter is often highly amusing. Their performances really tie the film together, which is vital for this to succeed, as their characters and their relationships are the linking devices that tie together a series of incidents that could easily be reduced to random vignettes. Oh, but what vignettes they would be! Then their incidents vary between tension-laden, exciting and stomach-churning, and that they're happening to people that it's quite easy to care about makes them rather effective and certainly attention-grabbing. There is perhaps not much more to contend with than these points in End of Watch, so I shan't belabor the issue. There's a solid argument to be made that, as a narrative piece, the film isn't exactly covering itself in glory, and perhaps also that the Mexican gang members in particular get the characterizations stuck on comic book moustache-twirling evil-come-homicidal, but I can't really see any of that detracting from your enjoyment of the film for all but the most demanding of audiences. There's also a decent amount of graphic violence here as well.
Yay!
With even the almost the extreme depicted without flinching, and that may be an issue for the more sensitive of audiences, so maybe be forewarned with that. But it is, to my mind, the most enjoyable cop-based film to appear this year, and is definitely worth investigation. Yes.
Yay, violence.
What's particularly shocking about it is that it's not then treated in any kind of glamorised way. It's just the simple fact of what happens when someone gets stabbed in the eye with a knife, and it's not good. And I think it's all the more shocking because it's not sort of played up in like slow-mo or anything. It's just, you know, half something you kind of come across and see.
You suddenly see it.
And there's a few moments like that where it's the actual fact that they've not made a point of showing you, or in most cases, even what's happened in the first place, and you just kind of stumble into results.
Yeah, it doesn't linger either, too. It's like, oh, look at us and look at our great makeup, and like, isn't this horrible? Look at the horribleness of it. It's not just like,
pointy things and eyes don't sit well with me. I might actually end up giving this a miss, man. That's no joke.
There are some stunning moments like that which really kind of drive home the kind of the sort of shitstorm that these guys kind of find themselves in at the end.
How can anything where someone gets knifed in the eye pass for a 15, man?
I was puzzled by that. I think it's restricted in the States, which makes more sense to me.
Yeah.
Memory serves, but 15's bizarrely lenient, especially given that it features all the trifecta of violence and swearing. Mm. And lots of it. I don't know how that works.
But at no point do you see an erect member.
There are no boobies, so therefore it's fine.
There's nae stiff boobies, so it's only a 15 here in the UK. It's one of that sounds like one of those things where, like, I know the BBFC, the British Board of Film Censorship, if you're listening outside the UK, or had a reputation in the past for being perhaps too strict, really, in terms of what can pass for a 15 certificate and stuff. But man, to me recently, even like in 12 certificate films now, it feels almost as if they're going too far the other way. I feel like part of a society where it's too acceptable to just go, well, it's kind of the norm now, so you can use this kind of language in a 12 rated film, and you can have people being shot in the face and all sorts, as long as you don't see any blood.
There's been a number of 12s in particular like that, where lots of people have been shot. It might even have been Total Recall, where the body count in that film is ridiculous, but because you don't really see any blood, so you can run through and murder hundreds as long as you don't linger on it too much. Yeah, that's apparently morally okay.
There's not dwelling on violence.
If you had a wee rant about that, Scott, it was Total Recall, because I agreed with you on that. It was the complete lack of consequence, which is why it's inappropriate for 12. It's not even it's the violence that's inappropriate for 12 rating. It's the fact that it's violence without any consequence at all.
What cracks me up about that, we're going off on a total tangent here, but I just have to say, like, what cracks me up about that is that we live in an age where the internet can provide you with all sorts of horrible, horrible revelations. And one of those revelations is that, by and large, if someone is casually shot in the head for real, there's actually not a lot of blood. Like, brains don't splatter over a wall and whatnot. It's, in a sense, this whole sort of notion of, as long as you don't show blood, you can get away, even if it's not fantasy violence. You know, you can have people running around shooting each other, and as long as you don't show blood, well, by and large, when people get shot, there aren't sort of great puffs of gore splattered all over the place. You'd be hard pushed to spot a bullet hole in them, but they're very real and very dead. And if anything, the sort of stuff they allow to pass, I would almost argue these days that actually I'll let it pass for a 12 if there is a ridiculous amount of blood splattered about, because that's entirely unreal and therefore clearly fantastical. Whereas to sort of casually shoot someone in the head, right, okay, that's probably, I'd call that being more realistic if there's not a great deal of blood knocking about. Oh, that's weird.
It seems particularly weird, actually, that these films can have these ratings too, when Sweeney Todd, which is clearly, like, it's cartoon violence and blood, is
named. Well, it's Sweeney Todd.
It made no sense
at
all.
Bizarre. The very thought of someone being stabbed in the eye, lingeringly or otherwise, in a film rated 15 strikes me as odd, but I don't know. Maybe just because I'm in my 30s now, I'm becoming a prude. That's weird, man. I'm deadly serious. I'll probably give this film a miss because I can't handle stuff like that.
If you can get through that, I would recommend it. I have to say it's one of the best films I've seen this year. It's maybe not quite the best film I've seen this year, but it's certainly going on my top 10 list. And unless something drastic happens in the next couple of weeks, it's definitely deserving of a place on that list. And I think if you can possibly shut your eyes at that point where you think it's going to happen, then give it a
bash. I was going to say, because I would have liked to have watched this, so perhaps outside of this podcast, after we're no longer recording, you can tell me unto whom it happens, and I'll watch it, and then I'll know to look out for it.
Yes, I think I'd probably agree with you there, Scott, and about where it's going to come from my films of the year. I'm not going to say too much about it because I agree almost completely with everything you said about it. The only real issue in terms of anything wrong with it is that the bad guys are a joke. they're so, compared to the two heroes, they're so badly and completely underwritten. And I did read a quote which I thought was spot on, which is that, you know, they've got all the depth of a Grand Theft Auto sub-villain. Which is really, it's spot on, because they're just, when I was watching it, that's exactly the sort of thing I was thinking of. It was like a silly wee video game character, when like you've got the women in the group going, yeah, fuck you, bitches.
Do all the guys in this, or do all the gangster guys in this wear white vests and ride about on BMX, ride about on BMX bikes, calling each other essay?
They don't have the bikes, but other than that, yes.
There are some white vests, so...
Do they all have, like, tribal tats on their upper arms?
They're really underwritten, and there's a couple of kind of naff lines to it, apart from what they've got. And when Jake Gyllenhaal asks one of the main gang members, why do they call you Big Evil? And his reply is, because my evil's big.
Wow. thank God for that, because I thought maybe it was because you were big and evil.
Yes, it's just a silly naff line, but it's completely negated and utterly made up for by the fact that it's, I think, without doubt the best, apart from probably Untouchable, it's the best chemistry between two leads I've seen this year.
Yeah.
As Scott said, it really does tie the film together. Gyllenhaal and Peña, they're wisecracking, and it just feels really believable, really natural, very, very realistic indeed, that these guys are friends and partners. They're just endlessly watchable.
Enough, like Peña, for all that he comes across as like an affable chap, he's always been a bit of a non-entity for me in the stuff that he's appeared in. So, but at the same time, it's sort of clear that he's has some sort of reasonable acting chops. So if he gets to stretch them in this, I'm glad.
It's a really entertaining film, and it would be worth it alone. It's like nice to see David Ayer actually try like the other side of the cop stuff this time and show them as heroes, which he certainly hasn't done in the past. But it's Peña and Gyllenhaal together that really make the film.
Awesome. That's good to know. Stabbed eyes aside. Well, guys, I think that just about covers it for episode 100, doesn't it?
It surely does.
Hot diggity dog. And with that, I guess it's time to bid adieu to episode 100. If you have been with us from the beginning to this point, please... Yeah,
we're sorry.
A, we're sorry. B, drop us a line, let us know, tweet us, whatever, do what you want.
C, do you need somebody to fill your prescription for
yeah,
you?
Yeah, exactly. Listen, email us at podcast@theoneliner.com, or you can tweet us directly at @theoneliner. You'll find our individual accounts, no doubt, if you just search for us by name. You can get in touch in any number of ways, so there's no excuse not to. And remember, please, if you get the chance...
Yeah, if you've got 2 minutes to spare, just hop on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast from. Leave us a review and a rating.
We're pointing you at iTunes. I mean, we wouldn't want anyone to use iTunes for any longer than they have
especially
to.
Especially iTunes 11, might I add. Fucking piece of shit. Yeah, we don't want to sound like we're begging, man, but it's like we are.
We are.
Help us raise our profile.
We're not proud.
Yeah,
we're
exactly.
Begging. Please rate us.
We're available for weddings, bar mitzvahs, whatever. Pop on iTunes from whence you subscribe to this goddamn stream and give us, even if it's shit feedback, man, come on, just feedback.
These Scotch gits are insufferable. 5 stars.
What a bunch of pricks. ... Unmissable. Unmissable. Has to be seen to be believed. On which note, I was Craig Eastman, and unto you I am eternally thankful. Drew was the sanctity.
Mixing it up.
The sanctity was almost breached. Scott was Scott.
Goodbye.
He was undoubtedly thankful to you for the last 100 episodes.
You're absolutely
and another
correct.
Man who yeah,
thank you.
Exactly.
Each and every one of you.
God damn it, we loves you. And someone else who I know genuinely from his massive heart. He's the biggest hearted man I know. Drew Tavendale, where you are, where you not, Drew.
I'll get back to you on that.
He was Drew and he was thankful. He's been thankful for the last 100 episodes also. So take it easy. We will be back with episode 101 at some juncture in the near future. Until then.
In the new year.
Yeah, in the new year. Fuck 2012, man. That's so this year, soon to be last year. It's only the future that counts, man. And 2013 is the future, assuming we're not all extinct on the 21st of December, which is a real possibility.
Oh, those Mayans.
Well, it wasn't those Mayans, was it? It's those people who decided to attribute it to those Mayans.
Of course. If you'd if you do think the world will end on the 21st of December, you're now banned from listening to our podcast.
Should we attempt to cobble together a podcast on the 21st of December just in case it's the last chance we ever get?
I'll try.
You know, you look at the way things are panning out in the Middle East, man, and you think, hey, it's not unfeasible, is it?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's partly why I'm going to Mexico. I'm either going to be really close to where it's all going to start or quite far away from where it's all going to start. So I figure either way, I'll win.
Either a quick death or none at all. Those are the best options. Yeah, Scott, you're going to Mexico, right?
I am. But I'm taking a microphone with me, so don't count us out.
Take a goddamn gun with you, man.
Well, given the Zetas, you should probably take a tank.
I was going to say, Los Zetas, Golf Cartel, any of those guys, do you know if they subscribe to the podcast?
There's only one way to find out. Please email us at podcast@theoneliner.com. Yes.
could you perhaps have a word with those guys? They're quite influential.
Yes, S.A. I shall.
Cool. Perhaps we could get them to hang their next set of victims from a bridge, each with a t-shirt on with one letter spelling out the one-liner as they...
There's no such thing as bad publicity. Is that what you're going for?
No. Listen, if you're a member of Los Zetas, Golf Cartel, Sinaloa Cartel, any of those other guys, too numerous to mention, if you're a member of a cartel in Mexico, do us a favour, man. You owe us. We made you who you are.
I'm not sure I want to pick sides in this war. Thanks.
I've pretty much just guaranteed myself a beheading by even talking about it, have I not?
Yeah, more or less.
Sweet. I hope they burn me with a blowtorch and peel my face off.
Well, you've got to have a dream. Because if you don't have a dream,
there goes your Christmas.
How are you gonna have
yeah,
a dream?
All I want for Christmas is to be brutally tortured then killed by a Mexican drug cartel.
And left quadrispas and a life.
Nah, I just killed. Scott, enjoy Mexico, man. Fucking nice knowing you.
Thanks.
I shouldn't keep this in. Bye!
Is it a sign of alcoholism if you just bring the bottle of vodka through with you?
Yes.
I haven't done that.